Hi everyone, and welcome to the Sporting Champions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, on iTunes, or at supportingchampions.co.uk to get these performance insights straight to your inbox. In this recording taken from the Sporting Champions Conference in 2017, physiologist and endurance coach Barry Fudge talks through his work in endurance athletics and his work with Sir Mo Farah.
Something I wish had been around when I was coming through the system, albeit elements of it were when Steve was in the various posts that he's done. I'm really aware that there's lots of different types of people in the room. There's aspiring practitioners, there's very experienced practitioners, there's leaders, there's coaches, there's all sorts. So what I've tried to do is give a bit of an overview of all the different areas that might be in the room with some key messages along the way. I'm no expert, but I have been involved with some people, one of them is Steve, who have done incredible things in sport. So I want to try and share some of that with you today. So as we go through, I don't think it's this sort of day where you can just shout things out, but by all means at the end, store up your questions and we'll go for it. So this is what we're going to try and do. I'm going to give you a bit of background info on British athletics, in particular the endurance programme, which is a bit more of that leadership type thing that I do now. I'm going to give you a bit of info around this kind of Project Mo, which is a bit more around how I worked as a practitioner in that environment. I'm going to give you some useful, hopefully, reflections on that process and some of the things that I've learned along the way. And then we'll finish up with a quick summary and a Q&A. So this is where I'm based in Loughborough. Some of you are really familiar with this, others not so much. I'm the head of endurance at British Athletics. I'm based in Loughborough, albeit not there very often, but that's our home. And one of the very unique things about the endurance programme at British Athletics is that we work in partnership with London Marathon. London Marathon provide us with financial assistance for our athletes that sit below the World Class Plan programme. So we have a very big programme. We have almost 50 athletes on programme. And that ranges from everything from somebody who runs an 800 all the way up to somebody who runs a marathon. And it includes people like Mo Farah at the top, all the way down to people who are just starting their journeys in terms of their sporting careers. And our vision that we have of London Marathon is on the bottom there, which is that for our best athletes to be successful in the world and European stage in order to inspire and motivate runners of all abilities. So it's kind of a grandiose title, but it's basically there saying we want people like Mo Farah, we want people like Laura Muir or the Sethcos or the Paula Radcliffe's of the past to be out there, to be on TV, to be successful so that it inspires a nation to get out and exercise. So that's the kind of overall aim. That's what London Marathon get out of it. That's what we hopefully provide to the nation. And I'm not going to bore you with this, but this is the complexities of the pathway, the people that we deal with in terms of home nations, different programmes, different mechanisms for funding, for support, for competitions and so on. So it's all I really want to demonstrate with that is it's broad, it's complex, and there are lots of different routes that athletes come through to be successful on training programs. And this is our funnel, and we do measure it, and we do go, well, hey, how many people are actually in our funnel? And just very, very quickly, I'm not going to bore you with the details, but obviously there's far more people at the top, and there's very few people at the bottom. And as we know, someone like Mo is the only one who's won a medal at the global level since Kelly Holmes in 2004. So there's very, very few people who go on and win medals. Very, very few people, but lots of people at different parts of the pathway. So that's all that's really there to show. And this year is an attempt, and again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it's just to show you that as a program, we're really interested in different parts of these pathways. We are really interested if Mo Farah wins a gold medal here, what effect does it have here? If we do coach education here or we have some initiative here, what effect it has on the whole pathway? And this is just data from all the different Olympic cycles since 2004 through to 2016. And it starts with the number of athletes we've got in the medal zone, all the way down to the number of athletes that we have hitting national standards around Britain. And as a programme, we're growing, we're getting bigger and bigger. We had something like 300 athletes making national standards in 2004. Now we've got way over 800, close to 900 athletes making national standards. So just as a general base, getting bigger, and we're seeing that right the way through the programme. So this will form part of a theme that I'm going to come through with, which is you've got to really understand what you're trying to achieve and what are the factors that actually affect it. Probably one of the things that I'm probably most proud about over the last few years is not necessarily the medals that we've won, but the number of athletes that we've put into finals, the number of athletes who have done better than we've done probably for two or three Olympic cycles. So that's demonstrated something called placing points. This works. Doesn't really show in there. Placing points is on the far left, on the bottom. We had our highest placing points since 1988 in terms of an endurance program. So more finalists, more medalists, more people getting to the top of the sport, which means hopefully come Tokyo in 4 years' time, as a sport we've got more people ready to medal than we've had since the 80s. So that's really encouraging. So again, it's useful to do it. And just to show that we do actually look at this stuff, and it is important, this is the number of people who run once a week in England. And it's growing all the time, and we know that because the number of marathons, half marathons, 10Ks, 5Ks, tough mudders, whatever, is growing. It's a huge, huge business now. And so we know that whether it's cause and effect doesn't really matter at this stage. There are more people running, there are more people getting active, and there's lots of different reasons for it. And I'm not suggesting that any of this is to do with it, but it's just to show that the pathway does all join up. And so this is my vision for the programme. This is the way I've kind of operated as a practitioner, albeit I didn't necessarily articulate it previously. I have this thing I call own the start line, and it's really, really quite cheesy, but hopefully it gives people an idea of what the programme is trying to do. And it's as simple as this. Your athlete stands on the start line, looks up and down at his other competitors, and they believe they are the best prepared athlete on that day. Now, being a sports scientist, being a physiologist, a lot of you probably think that means that they've done every single thing, like hypoxia, they've done cryotherapy, they've done S&C, they've done nutrition. It doesn't. It means, what is it that makes them comfortable on the start line and believe they're going to win? And in terms of a planning tool, which I'll go through and I'll show you an example, what that means is I start planning meetings with this simple philosophy, which is, imagine yourself standing on the start line in Tokyo 2020. What are the things that you would have had to have done to believe that you're going to win? And it's not just, you know, I need to go and train for 3 years. It's, what's the workout you needed to have done 10 days before that? How many days at altitude would you have needed to have done? What's your body weight going to be? Who are the people on your team that are going to make you successful? And the list just grows and grows and grows. It's amazing how many people get to about 2019, or will get to 2019, and just think it's going to happen in a year. So the philosophy is, own the start line, stand there, work out what it's actually going to take. And I'll show you an example of that as we go through with more. And one of the goals over the next 3 to 4 years is to take everything that we've learned from Mo Farah and start to transfer it into our younger athletes, like Charlie Rice here, who made an Olympic final in Rio in 1500, is to say everything we know from him and everything that we've learned as a program, as individuals, and athletes, we can transfer this into our younger generation of athletes that's come through. Because just to reiterate this again, it's very, very hard to win those sort of medals at those sort of championships. And everything we can get and learn is massively useful. And so one of the key things is talent. You know, train as much as I like, I will never be a distance runner. I could probably train every minute of the day for the rest of my life and I will never be a distance runner. Facts are, you need the right talent, you need the right materials, and we all know, to a certain extent, it's fairly intuitive, we know this, that some people just have it more than others. So we need to find the talent. And we put a reasonable amount of effort into finding that talent. It needs to be a lot better, but it's probably a lot better than it has been previously. And one of the things that we will do when we're selecting programs is basically try to work out who are the ones that are going to get closest to the medal, which of course is what UK sport demand offers. And one of the things that I've been trying to do, which is a bit Moneyball-esque, is to try and get this future medal index, which is just a different way of representing all these different factors like your PB, your top 5 times, your top 10 times, your yearly progressions, your ability to win races and all the rest of it into one number. And that's something that that as we move forward into the next cycle, we'll start to look at a bit more, which is to say, where is this talent? How does this talent navigate its way through our systems? How long does it take to win medals? And I'll give you a really good example of that as we go through. But this is just to say it's actually quite complex to figure out which of your athletes at different stages. It's easy to go, Mo Farah is a gold medalist, he's close to winning a gold medal. But when athletes are 6, 7, 8 years away from making a medal, it's very, very hard to know who they are. So as a program, we're trying very hard to figure out what it is that actually makes athletes successful. And a lot of that's actually more about just tracking the medalist over a period of time and seeing what they actually do. And I'll show you an example of that. It's something we call a performance funnel, which is how athletes navigate their way through pathways, how they navigate their way through to medal performances. But of course, talent's really important, and finding talent, and we all put huge amounts of effort into it. The other thing that's incredibly important is environment. Environment is one of the most important things, and I really like this quote by Daniel Coyle. And quite often I've done talks on is it nature versus nurture and do debates and things. And the reality is for me is it's nature times nurture. So you've got to have the genetic code, you've got to have that talent. But you then need to put people in the right place for the right people and the right things going on in order to be successful. And I'm gonna give you a really good example, and I think quite a simple one to understand, because we all kind of know this intuitively. But again, here's a really big one. So Mo Farah has an identical twin brother. He's identical in the sense that he's got the same genes. He looks exactly the same, but he doesn't run. So here we have this guy who has the genetics of a 4-time Olympic champion, 5-time world champion, probably the best distance runner ever, and he weighs 90 kilos, doesn't run, drinks a lot, smokes a lot, da-da-da-da-da. That's the difference in terms of what nurture can do. So I don't know who else is in this room right now, but you might have genetics of an Olympic rower or sailor or whatever. But it's the environment that you find yourself in that actually creates you. And it's that interaction with the environment that's so important. And this is our environment in the endurance program. This is Fornemont in France prior to Rio Olympics. It's our holding camp. Amazing places that we get to go to, but the main theme is generally altitude and warm weather. That's what we tend to crave, and as long as we've got a track and some running routes, we're generally quite happy. But the main reason for putting this up is just to demonstrate the sort of people that are involved in our program now, the sort of things that go on. So we obviously have athletes doing whatever the hell they do. We have a physiotherapist, we have soft tissue, we have a doctor, we have coaches, we have a physiologist. It's kind of crazy. Sometimes we have more staff than we have athletes at these sort of things. And I'm sure a lot of you are really aware who work in sport that sometimes this is what it looks like. But this is our team. We tend to travel everywhere together. And this quote by Steve Jobs is probably one of my favourite from him. And it really captures what we try to achieve within our programme. And this is the bottom bit is the way I like to think about what we're trying to do. Now, I'm not saying that we're perfect at this, and I'm not saying that we do this on a day-to-day basis, but this is what we're aspiring to do. And it's that simple notion that working together creates better athletes, better coaches, and better support staff. Together we're better, apart we're not so good. And that's the kind of thing that we're driving towards at all times, is to be better together. When I talk to the science team and the medical team that work with our athletes, it's like, don't make this shit up, do it properly, make sure we've got really good numbers, and you know, we'll invest into the EIS and other home nation institutes because we know that the data and the information we're getting is going to be very good. And the other one is, and the last one, which again, you guys are probably going, oh hey, I know all this, is just develop bespoke and innovation solutions to performance questions, right? So, you can't really get those performance questions if you don't have a close working relationship and the coach doesn't trust you. So that's why those things are really important. It's like, you've got to be able to ask good questions. Because look, most coaches and sports teams now, they know most of the answers. Like, hey, you're a nutritionist, you're a physiologist, you're gonna tell me to drink more water and less carbohydrate and da 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 da. You know, this is your heart rate. It's like, all right, okay. Most people can do that. And that's not really what being good is all about. It's about having those relationships and that trust so you can actually really figure out what it is that burning question is and how you can help. And I'm going to give you an example of taking a leap of faith as we go through, but sometimes that does mean, in terms of, that's kind of what you can replace innovation with sometimes, is you're going to take a leap of faith. You've got to try and do something that most people aren't going to try and do. Anyway, so this is the pyramid I use when I describe athletes within our program. Talent at the top. You can't do anything without talent. Talent's king. So there's no debate on that. But then you do need the right environment. And the last one, which I'm not really going to talk about too much, is mindset. But what you do find with a lot of athletes, certainly within athletics, and I'm sure it's the same in most other sports, is that, okay, so you've got the talent, but quite often they arrive with the talent and maybe the wrong environment, but they do have the right mindset. You tend to find that it might take them a few years to create the right environment, but they might eventually. And similarly, it's the other way around. So you can sometimes get away with talent and environment, or talent and mindset, and you can create the other one. But it's very hard to do anything without the talent. And just to show you about mindset, I've got a quick video which I'll talk through as it comes on, hopefully it will. This is Mo training last month in Ethiopia. He's doing, what did it say on there, 12800s or something in some hills. Why I put this after mindset is because this is a guy who is 4-time Olympic champion, 5-time world champion, he's got a silver medal at the Worlds, he's world record holder, and he's still busting his balls on the track in Ethiopia. That mindset is very, very hard to create in people. Very, very hard to create in people, and he has it in bags. It's an incredibly, incredibly tough thing to do. And as we go through, you'll see elements of it. But, I mean, he's killing himself. He's absolutely killing himself. And I'm kind of like, why? When's this going to end? When can I go home to my family? When can we stop doing this shit? We've been doing this for however long. But the point is, it's just in him. It's his mindset, and you know, Pete's talking later, Mark, and it'll be interesting to see what they talk about, psychology, mindset, and all the rest of it, because I think this is very hard to create. This is very, very hard to create. So finding the right mindset is very hard, and that's not just the athletes, that's the coaches and the support staff and the people that work in programs. They've got to be a little bit crazy, and they've got to be a little bit out there to be successful at this level. And the point is, to be consistently successful. Because Mo could win one medal and walk away into the distance and it'd be great and he would achieve everything and more than anyone's ever done. But the point is, he's still been out there killing himself and he probably will for the next couple of years. So just to summarise this a little bit, the support team is there to support the athlete and coach on the journey, and I'm going to go into a bit more detail in the last section about what people might do which is wrong in terms of doing that. And talent is king. It's very rare that people make the top consistently without a team. So you should always be thinking team, team, team. There's always somebody there that can help you and support you, give you some new ideas, refresh ideas, whatever it might be. And then this, again, these things seem obvious, but it's amazing how many people just don't do it. It's like build good relationships, talk to people, work as a team, ask good questions. It's like, it's there. Right, so Project Mo. What I'm going to do here is go through a kind of planning session with some examples of things that we might have done or talked about, just to give you an idea of the sort of things that have gone on in Project Mo. Although it should be Sir Mo now. As I see, you've got it right, Steve, I didn't. So this is the problem. And actually, this is the slide that we used back in 2009 when I came into post at the EIS. This is the problem. It was 4 years for the Olympics, but it was really more or less three. Kenny Musubikili was the reigning double Olympic champion over 10,000 and 5,000. He ranked number one, was 12.50 in 26.25 events. This is what Mo was doing. He was ranked 43rd in the semi-9 in the world, hoping to beat this guy, or people like him. So that was the problem. And you're kind of going, right, not sure this is going to work. As we go through the process, you can start to see how things do come together. And this is a model that I made up, and it's nothing glamorous or sexy or whatever. It's just a thought process around how you go from thinking about what you want to do to how you actually achieve it, or try to achieve it. And I call it an ADAPT model because the words seem to work together, and I thought that was pretty cool. But it starts with A, which is ambition. What is it you actually want to do? And I'll go through an example, the example of Mo Farah in this. What is it you actually want to do? And depending on the level of people that you're working with, it can be anything from I want to win a gold medal, all the way down to I just want to make the team. or, you know, I want to run a PB next year. So it works on scale. It works whatever you're trying to do, and it probably works in life and business and everything, because this is such a simple way of just doing it. And then the D is determinants. It's like, hey, what does this actually look like? What does it actually take to do what you're talking about? And that's not just, you know, an example I'll use is more numbers and so on, but it's like, what does your lifestyle need to be like? You know, what people who win gold medals at the Olympics, what do they do? What does it look like? What does their finances look like? Where are they getting the money from to train full time? What's their diet like? What's their body composition like? I used to say, I was like, the people who are winning gold medals at the Olympics in distance events for men, they weigh less than 60 kilos, they're like children. So you strolling around 65 kilos, 70 kilos, ain't going to do it, unless you're a complete freak. So it's like, understand your numbers, understand where these people come from. Assess, so it's like, well, where am I now? So I want to win a gold medal, I know it's going to take this, where am I? And that's where a lot of our support services come in, and our coaches and so on, that say, this is where you are now. So you might go and get your physiology test, or you might go get your body composition test, or you might go and see the performance lifestyle advisor, and they tell you you're here. You're red, amber, green, or you need a bit of work. Anyway, whatever way people do it. And then it's the process, the prioritization of tasks. And I really like this 80-20 rule, which I'm sure you've all heard, which is basically saying you get 80% of your benefits or your maximum gains from 20% of the effort. And I think that's probably the case with most things in life, but it's certainly the case within sport, in my experience, that there's probably a huge list of things that can be done, but there's probably only one or two of them that will really make a difference. We could go on all day with a list of things that athletes and coaches could do. But how many of them actually move your program forward towards your goal? And so this is the bit that I think is neglected a lot, particularly in the high performance system, is this prioritization of tasks. What's the process? How are we going to get down to the bits that are actually going to make a difference? And if you get that bit right, you're going to do pretty well. I think one of the things that we all like to do is we like to do the easy stuff. We like to do the things that are like, you've got to get your nutrition right, you've got to get your this right, you've got to do that. Yeah. It's like, that's easy. What are the tough questions you need to ask about what's going to move this athlete forward? Anyway, going all day about that. But the process is a really, really important part of that system. That you just go, these are the two bits that we're going to work on this year. I'll give you one example of what that looks like. So, I remember I used to do, when Steve finished up his post as physiologist, he thankfully, handed me over all the sprinters for body composition. It's like, you do them. And they all come in like, get my body comp done. And some of them are a bit overweight, a bit fat. And you have this conversation and they're talking about, give me the best supplement program you've got. I need to lose weight, I need to cut, I need to do this, I need to do that. Point is like, you're 10 kilos overweight or whatever, and you don't know how to cook, you don't know how to go shopping. It's like, well, the first thing you probably should do is learn how to go shopping, learn how to cook, and then we can talk about a supplement program. So it's just a simple example of the easy thing to be here, take a bag of supplements and get on with it. But the reality is that they needed to do that first. And it's probably the same that, you know, there's no point in you doing a biomechanics session over there if you're 5 to 10 kilos overweight. Let's sort this bit out first, because that means shit. There's no point. You're just wasting everyone's time. And then the team, which is a lot of what we talked, you know, I've already talked about, Steve talked about, I'm sure people will talk about through the day, is you've got to then sit down and say, you're in my team. These are the people that are accountable within my team. This is your S&C coach, this is your manager, this is daddy, that, yeah. Like, athletics is different. Like, it seems to be we have all these freaking agents for everything. But, you know, this is my team. These are the people that are going to help me achieve my goals. You're accountable for this, and we're going to sit down in 6 months and talk about this. Again, high-performance sport is probably different than professional football and rugby and all the rest of it. But in high-performance sport, that can be neglected. So that's the system, adapt. So I'm going to give you an example of the conversations, not necessarily formally like on a bit of paper and all the rest of it, but the way the conversations were shaped around Mo Farah in 2009 in terms of the model. So ambition, what is it you actually want to do? Well, I want to win 5,000 and 10,000 meter double at the Worlds and the Olympics. All right, okay, that's good. The determinants. So this is just some numbers and so on, just to give you a flavour of it. You can break this down into so many different things. But just take the 5,000. The technical element is, well, you've got to be able to run 146, which is 226, for the last K race. If you don't run less than 226, might as well not bother. in terms of winning medals. That's where you've got to run. We know that's where you've got to run. Your last lap has to be in 54 seconds or less within that K. So you need to be able to run less than 54. Now, you can run the world record for 5,000 the week before, but if you can't run less than 54 for the last lap and be in contention by running 226, you're not going to win anything. That's it. That's the determinants. And then we forget about the final, but we know that you need to be going in sub 13 minutes, 12:57, in terms of 5K. It's not the fastest time in the world, but it just demonstrates a minimal amount that you have to do in terms of engine size and performance going into a championship. So you need to be able to run under 13 minutes, you need to be able to run under 226 per K, you need to be able to run under 54 for the last lap. That's your minimum to be in for a chance at a medal. Then the other thing that you pick up, the non-technical stuff, which is, well, you know, minimal time off injuries, can't get hurt, don't want to get hurt. If you get hurt, you lose consistency, you go backwards. Ultimately, and people will argue about altitude and all the rest of it, but every medalist that ever goes to the World Champions or Olympics in endurance events has used altitude training. So I put that down as a determinant. And there's lots of stuff like, you've got to be lean and powerful, recovery plan, nutrition, this is just stuff that's a few of. So just the assess part, well, where are you now? Well, your last K, the best you've ever done is 147.5. So you're second and a half slower than the medalist. Okay? Last 400, you're two seconds in a bit slower than the medalist. So there, straight away, you're like, all right, okay, there's something to work with here. He was lean, but he wasn't powerful. He never lifted a weight in his life. No plan for recovery. He used to go off to Kenya and train. He had no plan. He's just like, hey, I was going to train. So that's where he's at. This is the performance funnel that tells us all the information we need to know around what athletes do for 6 years leading into a championship. So the blue line is basically saying, it goes from 2012 to 2017, because that's the most recent selection that we've done. You've got to be above the blue line or on it if you're on target for a medal from 6 years into championships. So it's just to give you a bit of an insight in terms of how we do it. We just collect that data and we look at it every year. What did the medalist do? What did that medalist do? To say, what are the determinants to make that up? And this is a complicated slide. I prefer something that looks a bit more like this, because it's got things that we can measure in the lab. I'm making it simplistic. There's a whole bunch more stuff that goes in. But it's just to say, the physiology required to run those times fits into these sort of simple models, and it fits into being able to test. And those who were around back in 2009-10, this is the old EIS lab. I was already going bald at that point. Mm-hmm. First time I tested Mahoney. And for those who are familiar with the numbers, he got up to 24 kilometres an hour at the end of his submax test. And straight away I was like, this kid's good, bloody hell. So I was beginning to understand that. And the thing that I'm really keen on, and the thing that I've already talked about, is altitude. And this, I'm not going to go through this, but this slide is there to demonstrate that when you do endurance training in altitude, you get a far better stimulus for all the things that are important for the model that I've just put up. So oxygen signaling, oxygen carrying, carbohydrate metabolism, mitochondrial biogenesis, you get a bigger bang for your buck when you exercise in altitude. So a big part of the program is altitude, and I haven't got time to go into the model, but a big, big part of it was we've got to do this altitude training bit right. And so we over the years, we came up with a strategy that was basically, you know, this is how you go from November through to August, and these are the different heights that we use, and it's a completely different lecture. But it's basically saying we have different strategies of altitude training. We have different places that we go to, there's different competitions, there's different testing, but we deliver you to on the day to your championships doing this. And the bit that was a leap of faith, the example I was going to use was using an altitude tent. And I'm not going to go into the details of it because it will take all day, but it was basically saying, how do we make something better than what the Africans do? How do we do something that we can have an advantage on, or we believe we're going to have an advantage on, that the Africans don't do? It was an altitude tent. And we use altitude tents to supplement altitude training around major competitions. And it's just to say, actually, no one else was doing that. It was a bit of a leap of faith, and it could have gone tits up. But the point is, we tried it in safe environments. We tried it in different competitions. We tried it at European Championships. we came up with a model that was successful. So it's good to make leaps of faith, but do it in a safe environment that's not going to cost you your job or the athlete your competition medals or whatever. But that could be the thing, if you're brave enough, that helps them achieve your goals. This is what a plan looks like now for an athlete. So this is Mo again, for, I think this was last year actually. But it's basically, the top half is the numbers required, so it's got the last 400, last 1,000 finish time, this is 10k instead of 5k. What the general stride length would be, frequency, hemoglobin mass, VO2 max, all that kind of stuff. And says, right, this is where you are. And then there's this idea of, well, what's the physical, which is the talent, mental, it's a mindset, environment. These are the things that we think are important. And this is how we make sure we're not complacent with our program, that we check in on a planner like this. So that's where we've got to. And just to give the numbers of the 2012 final, so his season's best in him was 12:56 in brackets is what he ran in Rio, before going into Rio. So he ran 12:59 in London this year, just to give a bit of contrast. So he needed to run 12:57, that's what we said. So it was about right, sub 13 minutes basically. The last kilometre in London was 1:45.2. In Rio, he ran 1:45.6, so numbers stack up. We said he's got to be able to run sub 2:26, 1:46, whatever numbers. The last 400 in London was 52.9, and Rio was 52.8, so consistent. We said we're going to have to run under 54. Point was actually that Mo moved that game on from being able to run, most people would run 54 to win a gold medal, you're now going to run 52. And this is probably the world final in 2015, I think, was his best ever race. It was phenomenal. Best shape he's ever been in. And he actually had a torn hamstring at this point as well, which is quite remarkable. But he went through the last mile in 3:55, the last kilometre in 2:19, the last 800 in 1:48. So 1:48 was as quick as Rudisha ran his 800 in. He then went through in 52.6 for the last 400. Those are phenomenal times. Best race he's ever done, I would say, by a long way. I want to give you a bit of perspective because although I'm here talking about Mo Farah and I've been part of his journey and I've been really privileged to it, it's been a very, very long time in the making. And through that journey, there's been lots of different people involved at different stages of his career. I've been really fortunate and really privileged to be part of a very successful part of it. But what I tried to do was say, well, look, if you put Mo's running career into a 9-to-5 job, when was he successful? How long did it take? How long was he successful for? And so when he started running in 97, or about then, when he was 14, it took him all the way until 10:03 in the afternoon before he got his first global medal. So he worked all day, 10:03 in the afternoon before he got his first one. I came in around 2 o'clock. So I'd been kind of chilling out all morning, like I do. And actually, the scary thing is that, so he starts winning at 10:03, his window of success is only about an hour and a half, and he's worked all day for it. Anyway, just to give you a bit of perspective, and all this time, there's lots of different people and lots of different things and all sorts going on in the program. It might look easy, but there's been a huge amount of work. How am I doing for time, guys? Am I 5 minutes late? I'll skip through this next bit. So the key points from this are, know, truly, truly understand what you're trying to do. Really understand it. Really understand it. Because if you don't, it's very hard to focus on the things that are going to make a difference. And try some novel things. Like, you know, it might take a while for you to get that trust and that relationship, but part of this process has got to be trying new things, but in safe environments. And this is quite quick. Just some useful reflections of working in high-performance sport. Simon Sinek's book, Steve's already talked about Simon Sinek, Start With Why. I think it's really important that everyone understands why they do what they do. And I'm going to explain why now. If it's for money, now it may be different if you're working in professional sports like football and rugby, I don't know. But generally speaking, if it's for money, don't bother being a sports physiologist or nutritionist. There's no money. It's not for money. It can't be for money, it can't be for fame, it can't be for glory. You're the backroom guy, you're the guy who isn't getting the medals. If you want to stand up on the podium when you're an athlete, that ain't going to happen either. And Tony will probably tell you that later as well. He doesn't stand on the podium and everyone claps and applauds him and he walks away with a cheque for $1 million. It doesn't happen. So if you're in it for the money, and you're in it for the medal, and you're in it for the fame, forget it. You're in it for the wrong reasons. And just to come back on a little bit of, well, you know, it's very easy to think that when you're young and naive, which I was once coming into this profession, that it should just be like that. You've all seen this. The reality is it's an absolute bloody mess, and sometimes you get to the top and tomorrow you'll be back down in the depths of despair or whatever. But that's what it really looks like. And that's the truth. It's not easy. It's not bag of flowers or whatever. Because shit does happen. And it's an example of all falling in the 10,000. You know, your athlete might fall over. Your athlete might get hurt. Your team might not win. Shit will happen. And it will happen again and again and again. And then it can get really bad. I called it Annus Horribilis 2015. It was a terrible, terrible year. Absolutely terrible. Drug allegations, all sorts of stuff going on. Paul Radcliffe, Mo Farah. It was terrible. Nobody wanted to be there. But the point I'm making is about, if you know why you're doing what you're doing, this doesn't mean anything. And when shit happens, it doesn't mean anything. So, and when you win stuff as well, or you're part of a team that wins, it's really important to know why you're there. Because if you're there for the money and your guy wins, you're going to be incredibly disappointed when you walk away and you ain't the one with the chip. That's the truth. So you've got to be in it for the right reasons, you've got to be doing it for the right reasons. Because when it goes tits up, which it will, you've got to be there for the right reasons. And when it goes really well, which hopefully it will, you've got to be in it for the right reasons. Because either way, you get found out. And this is how Moore reacted. This is the mindset. This is how Moore reacted 2 weeks later when we were in Japan training for the champs. Does he look upset? Obviously, he's devastated about what's happened and all the rest of it, but he's focusing on his training. He's getting on with it. It's the right mindset. What happened to him in 2015 would have killed most athletes. And it would have killed most people within his team. And he sat us all down and he said, I don't give a shit what people are saying. I don't care what's going on out there. We've got one job to do. That's it. That's the mindset. That's the sort of people that the sort of person that he is. So look, this is to finish off. The main thing is that it's not about you. It's about supporting the athlete or the coach or the team, whatever it is you're working on their journey. The work with the people around you is very easy to be somebody that, you know, as an outsider, doesn't want to interact with them because they're crap or they've got stupid ideas and they don't get on with them. Coming together is really, really important. Talent, environment, mindset, pretty straightforward. Again, just really, really understand what you're trying to do. Really understand it. Understand what your competitors are doing. Understand what people historically have done. Look at it. Really understand it. And just remember why you're doing what you do, or why you got into sport or whatever you're doing, because it's really important. Because one day when you are successful, or one day when it goes crap, it won't feel nice. And the last bit really, and Steve said this at the beginning, is have fun. This is sport. It's meant to be fun. It is meant to be fun. And sometimes we can all get a bit bogged down in sport and what it means, and medals this and money that and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, it is sport. I started working in sport because I thought it would be fun. And it is fun 95% of the time. So key thing is, have fun, don't be a miserable bugger, speak to people, and that's what that kind of site says. So I'm done.
Thank you very much, Barry.
For more recordings from the Supporting Champions Conference or our podcast, visit the Performance Vault at supportingchampions.co.uk. You can also log in to join the discussion live, or you can join us at one of the Supporting Champions events for performance-focused development and networking.